Hello, fellow rebel capitalists. Hope you're well. Wanted to go over a chart that I think is going to absolutely knock your socks off. So hopefully you're sitting down because it is definitely stiff drink time. To use a phrase from one of my whiteboard videos. Let's get right into the chart from my good friend Jeff Snyder. And we're going to think through what on earth is happening with bank reserves prior to the GFC compared to after the GFC. And what does that tell us about what could happen, not only the stock market, but the real estate market and the cost of the stuff you buy daily moving forward into 2022. I'm going to try to connect all these dots for you right now. So let's check out this blog post from my good buddy Snyder, and let's go all the way to the top. This is part two. I would strongly suggest going over this. I went over a piece of this with Joseph Wang yesterday, but this is on Jeff's website, alhambrapartners.com, and this is the part two of a two-part series, Bank Reserves, part two. If QE was really QT, then why hasn't QT been QE? All right, so we're going to focus on the chart all the way at the bottom here. And if you didn't get that title, don't worry about it. We're going to focus on something a little bit different. So this is the Fed's balance sheet, and these are the reserve balances for the bank entities, the financial institutions that have an account with the Fed. So if we go back prior to the GFC, you don't see much. In fact, I've pulled up several charts on this. You usually see maybe $30 billion, 30 with a B, maybe $40 billion. If you look at total deposits, though, you'll see something close to, $6 trillion. So let's think about that. And we had all these reserve requirements, and supposedly everything in the U.S. banking system, every transaction for that matter, is supposed to settle on the Fed's balance sheet. And that's if we are to assume that central banks are actually central. And of course, I'm bringing up another hypothesis or another thing that Jeff says all the time, and that's that central banks are in fact not central to the economy. And I think this or these two charts really prove that definitively. Now, what percentage of the daily transactions are settled on the Fed's balance sheet and maybe just between the commercial banks themselves? Then how much of that is inside the United States? How much is outside of the United States? Is it settled daily? Is it settled every 2 weeks? Is that an agreement between the banks themselves or the intermediary, which is called a corresponding or correspondent bank relationship? I'm taking that straight from the Bank of England's website, talk about cross-border payments. And they're referring to it as a correspondent bank. Make sure I get my terms. I'm very good with the concepts, but sometimes I kind of forget the actual terms they use. And so this would be Jeff Snyder's view where, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but after, you know, I know Jeff well, and I've spoken to him countless times, and I've read so much of his stuff. And in my opinion, his view is that the majority of what's being settled is just between banks, just like this. Just they're sending them their, you know, whatever they consider to be an asset. They're sending them that dollar or that commercial bank liability. So customer A wants to transfer money to customer and Bank A wants to transfer money to customer B at Bank B. And it's just simply Bank A sending them those liabilities, because remember the checking deposits are liabilities of the commercial bank. And then Bank A would also have to send them assets. Well, what assets are they sending them? Whatever Bank B will accept. And if Bank B just accepts an IOU, so be it. No big deal. Now, is that IOU for a day, for a week, 2 years? Who knows? All Bank B is doing is extending credit to Bank A, just like the bank would extend credit to you. So in this transaction, there are no bank reserves that are part of the process. There's no settlement on a central bank's balance sheet. Now, again, I believe that this system was most likely used to a greater degree prior to the GFC. To what degree it's being used today in the United States, outside, who knows? No, I don't think anyone really knows definitively. I think there's people that would argue this system is 90%. I think other people would argue it's 1%. But it's fascinating, and I think we really need to get our heads around how it actually works so we can draw our own conclusions. Because if you don't, again, I think as an investor, you're just whistling by the graveyard. You're not paying attention to a cross current that could completely overwhelm all of the other cross currents that you're actually cognizant of. The example I always use, the real estate investor, 2006. They're very cognizant of school districts, of their loan relationship with the bank, their positive cash flow, the forced equity. They're all these things, you know, demographic studies, population inflows, outflows. They know that like the back of their hand. But if they're totally oblivious to what's going on with mortgage-backed securities or with Lehman Brothers or Bear Stearns, as an example, it doesn't matter how good you are at the micro stuff, you're going to get completely overwhelmed. Your entire portfolio is going to be completely overwhelmed by that macro cross current. And I think today, especially in 2022, we live in an environment where we have all of these GFC type of events that are possible that we've got to pay attention to. And if we don't, I think we leave ourselves open to being in the exact same position as that real estate investor in 2006. So anyway, let's go back to the balance sheet of, right here. And the balance sheet of the Fed, these are the reserve balances. So again, we see that prior to the GFC, the entire system of, I mean, obviously a lot more than $5 trillion. Snyder would argue that, I mean, who knows what's on the bank's balance sheets between them in these correspondent relationships. If I'm getting the word right again, I'm always forgetting the word here. Bear with me, guys. Correspondent. Yes. Okay. Got it. But with these correspondent relationships, basically the ledger system between the banks themselves, but then how many dollars are in the euro dollar system outside the United States when in 2006, seven, they had $5 trillion in the United States? Who knows? Who knows? So you think about globally, if this system revolved, the dollar system revolved around the Fed, theoretically, that $30 billion or $40 billion in reserves was backing up $20, $30, $40 trillion. Who knows? But so we can't see what's in the shadows. We can't quantify that. But what we do know, and this is Jeff's point, or one of his points in this chart, is that prior to the GFC, and I'm going to read what he said here, the Fed is doing nothing while the banks were doing a lot. See, what he's saying there is exactly what I was talking about, that not much is happening here on the Fed's balance sheet with bank reserves. That's the liability of the Fed. Therefore, the banks themselves had, with their balance sheets, with these correspondent relationships, or just between the banks themselves with the ghost ledger, they had to be doing a lot of the overall activity that we couldn't see. That was in the shadows. But then what happened is the GFC, Fed's balance sheet explodes. And keep in mind, this article where Jeff wrote this was back in 2018. If we looked at it now, the reserves are way up here. They would literally be off Jeff's chart at, last time I checked, they're over $4 trillion of bank reserves. I'm sure it's even higher now. So then he moves on to his next point, which is really kind of gives you this epiphany moment. Quantity of reserves only imply what the Fed is doing, not what banks are doing. And the latter is far more important. Thus, if the Fed is doing something, then it's likely in response to what banks are not doing. So this chart, in Jeff's opinion, isn't just a chart of the Fed's balance sheet and quantitative easing. It's a chart of what the banking system is not doing today that they were doing prior to the GFC. Now, I would ask you that as a fellow rebel capitalist, do you think we might not be big fans of the commercial banking system, but it is far more decentralized than the central bank, the Federal Reserve. Who do you think is going to create more economic growth, right? Or more economic activity? When the banking system is in charge of everything that's going on, or when the Fed has to create all of these reserves to as a subsidy? I think another way to look at these reserves is it's the actual heroin that is being injected into the system to make up for the, it's not even like the heroin. It's like a drug that's being injected into like a patient that's in a coma that just sustains them, that just keeps them alive. So prior to the GFC, this human being, this patient, we'll call them, was very healthy. His body was creating everything that the body needed to sustain life. It was functioning properly, right? But then the GFC, and the guy gets hit by a car. All of a sudden, his body isn't performing the functions needed to sustain life. So you put him on life support. And I think the Fed's balance sheet is basically a mirror into how unhealthy the economy is, because it's basically life support for that person who got hit by the car. In this case, it's the economy that got hit by the car and that has never recovered. And unfortunately, with the quantitative easing of the Fed increasing their balance sheet, the more life support they give the patient, the more unhealthy the patient gets, and the more the body is dependent upon that life support. This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for. Why is this important? Well, let's think about what the Fed is talking about doing in 2022. They're talking about tapering, which is taking the quantitative easing, the life support, down to zero. They're talking about raising interest rates, which is not only taking away the life support, but it's basically like taking the patient out of the hospital bed and putting them in a walker and saying, okay, go for it. you're on your own. But then, in addition to that, they're talking about doing quantitative tightening, which is reducing what they have already given this person. And if we're using the same example, it would be like taking the life support down to zero. It would be like putting them on a walker. And then it's not even like giving them physical therapy or anything. It's like putting a 200-pound weight on their back while they're trying to use that walker, just after getting out of bed for 6 months being on life support. That's basically what the Fed is talking about doing to the economy in 2022. Okay, so you think through that, and you're like, okay, well, that could be very deflationary, right? And as also, you think about interest rates going up, that means that payments on debt that's being rolled over, that goes up, or on new debt, the cost, the price of the debt goes up, that means less demand because you have less purchasing power, especially with assets that require debt to purchase them. Talking about housing. So housing effectively gets more expensive. Stocks get more expensive as well because those margin accounts now have a higher rate of interest. And we talk about this rotation from growth stocks into value stocks. Okay, we got that. But all the PEs most likely will compress. I'm not saying the stock market goes down, but it definitely gives it a massive, massive headwind. Okay, I think most of us get it. But what I haven't heard anybody talk about is how the supply-demand equation is much different with assets than it is with consumer goods and services. Let's think this through. So we're in this environment where the Fed is taking away the life support. They're taking the patient, giving them a walker, putting a 300-pound weight on their back. And this is what they're doing basically to the stock market, to asset prices. Okay, and you say, George, well, that's definitely deflationary. Okay, well, that doesn't necessarily mean, because it's deflationary for asset prices, doesn't necessarily mean that it's deflationary for consumer goods and services. Why? Because of this different dynamic, supply-demand dynamic that I'm referring to. There's a lot of different variables here. There's a lot of different reasons we could see this come play out. This is what we saw in the early 1970s when the stock market went down from 72 to 74 in nominal terms by 50%, while we still had extremely high consumer price inflation. As a lot of you remember, you guys have studied in your history books, for those of you who are a little bit younger. But what is the supply side of the stock market? Well, that would be shares. What is the supply side of housing? Housing stock. Okay. Well, when you're levered up, like our assets are in the United States, what happens when prices of stocks really start to go down? Will we have more supply or less supply? We could be in an environment where we have more supply because those corporations need cash. Therefore, they have to sell more equity, but they might not have a choice. The credit markets freeze up. Who knows what happens? But we've seen this since the GFC, where as stocks go up, the supply decreases because these corporations are buying their shares back, right? But we could see the opposite, the mirror image, where stocks are going down and the supply is actually increasing because the corporations are either selling what they purchased or they're creating more equity to send out there to the market because that's the only liquidity they can get. Where with consumer goods and services, if we see the demand side of the equation go down, meaning purchasing power is being restricted because interest rates are going up, we could see the supply side, and I think it's very likely that the supply side is restricted even further or at a faster rate than the demand side is going down. Therefore, consumer prices still go up. You see, the supply side, I think, is much different. Where if prices are going down with assets, you could see an environment where it increases supply. Where if the demand side or the purchasing power with consumer goods and services, if that goes down, I think it could mean supply decreasing at an even faster rate. So on this side, demand goes down, let's say, and supply could go up, exacerbating the problem. On this side, demand goes down, but supply goes down even faster, pushing prices back up. I'm not saying that this is a prediction. I would say that the concept, my base case is that if stocks go down or if asset prices go down in nominal terms, that does not mean that the groceries you buy at the grocery store will go down in price. I don't think your rents are going to go down. I don't think the stuff that you buy daily is going to go down, regardless of what's happening to the stock market. That's my base case. Now, there could be a variety of reasons that happens. What I just outlined may or may not play into my base case coming to fruition, assuming that it does. But I don't hear anybody talking about those dynamics. And I think they're definitely a cross current that could be at least powerful enough to where we should be talking about it right now. So I wanted to start by getting you guys in the mindset of thinking about, you know, the Fed, what they've done, obviously look at their balance sheet. This is a sign of an unhealthy economy, not a healthy economy. This is a sign of a very unhealthy banking system in the sense that, okay, we're not really risking a bail in here because they're so flushed with reserves. But to Jeff's point, they're not doing what they were doing prior to the GFC. And that's at the very least got to make you scratch your head. And then we look at what the Fed is talking about doing in 2022. Then we look at the difference between the demand supply dynamics with asset prices compared to consumer goods. And again, I think that there are no certainties, there are only probabilities, but there's a high enough probability that we see this play out the way I described it, to where we should at least be considering it and trying to say to ourselves, okay, if this does play out, then how is my portfolio set up to handle such a sequence of events going into 2022? All right, guys, enjoy the rest of your afternoon. Make sure that you're always standing up for freedom, liberty, free market capitalism. We'll see you in the next video.